Thank you both. My name is Tracy Smith, presiding judge. I'm joined here by Judge Wheelock and Judge Gaitis. This case is 822-1844, State of Minnesota versus Charlene Marie Waldron, appellant. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case is being conducted via Zoom, but an audio recording only will be posted later on our website. And if you're ready to go, counsel for appellant, we are ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of appellant Ms. Waldron. The issues in this case all regard the effect of a defendant's legal incompetence at the time she made a statement and what effect that has on the admissibility of that statement. The three issues before the court today have to do with whether that statement was in violation of Miranda, whether that statement was involuntary, and whether the admission of that statement in its form violated Rule of Evidence 403. Now, this statement was obtained immediately following a rollover vehicle accident in which Ms. Waldron sustained a head injury that rendered her legally incompetent. She was found not to be criminally responsible for her actions that immediately preceded that car accident. This is exactly the time during which the statement that was used against her at trial was obtained. She was questioned by two armed officers in uniform. She was not given a Miranda warning, and they asked her numerous questions about what she was doing that night, who was driving the vehicle, whether she'd been drinking. And in response, she makes several conflicting and incoherent statements about her boyfriend being the driver or who was being the driver. Those inconsistent and incoherent statements were ruled admissible at trial. The district court ruled that the squad video footage containing the statements and the results of the subsequent blood test were admissible under the rescue doctrine to Miranda. But the rescue doctrine did not apply to the circumstances of this case.
There was Ms. Lockwood, would you agree that the threshold question here as to your Miranda issue is whether there was a custodial interrogation?
I would agree with that, yes.
It doesn't look like the district court really addressed that question. Do we have the authority to go ahead and address it ourselves?
Yes, you do. The standard of review here is de novo, so you can look at the facts that were presented to the district court and apply the law independently. That also includes looking at the facts that support custodial status and applying the law to that independently. I understand there are no explicit findings made by the district court. They just simply jumped to the second prong of the Miranda analysis and found that it was an exception to Miranda under the emergency exception.
So given that you agree that that's a threshold issue that this court can take a look at based on the existing record, what facts indicate that this was a custodial interrogation? And, you know, I think you can assume that we're familiar with the videotape, which contains the interactions between the responding officer and everyone else. Although you can't see them, you can just hear them.
Correct. I think the undisputed facts of this case established that Ms. Waldron was not interviewed in a police station. She was interviewed in a home by armed and uniformed police officers. That was not her home in which she was interviewed. She was not in the comfort of her own home, in a place where she felt safe and secure and free to leave at any moment. In fact, she was in a stranger's home where she had gone to seek help after being in a serious car accident and was very distressed and trying to seek medical attention at the time she was being questioned. It's not clear due to her incompetency at the time whether she was aware she was a prime suspect in a crime, but we all know from a review of the record that she was being suspected of DWI here, and the questions were aimed at discerning whether she was the driver of the vehicle and whether she'd been drinking alcohol that night. Those questions were pointed and aimed at getting her to confess that she was driving under the influence of alcohol.
How are those questions any different than the sort of roadside questions that occur during a stop for suspected DWI which courts have determined not to constitute custodial interrogations.
This was not a stop at a roadside. This is not someone who was actively driving a vehicle and then was pulled over by police and questioned on the roadside. This is someone who was in a car accident, possibly even hours prior, and had been experiencing hypothermia, frostbite, and other injuries when she came to this home seeking help. And then she was surprised and approached by police officers when she was attempting to seek refuge. This is not the same as a situation where someone sees the police putting on their squad lights, pulling her over, approaching her vehicle, and she has time to prepare and know what is going on. She's about to be questioned through roadside questioning. These are two very different scenarios, and it's not the same analysis that can apply to a roadside questioning because it's just not what we have here. These police officers were called to report to the scene of this accident and then this home to investigate Miss Waldron, not on a roadside, and they hadn't pulled her over and given her any notice as to why she was being pulled over and what the suspicion may be. Additionally, she did make significantly incriminating statements during the interrogation that also leans toward her being in a custodial status at the time. A person under these circumstances, especially a person who'd been in a significant car accident, being asked if she was drinking alcohol by uniformed armed police officers, would believe that they were in custody to the degree associated with a formal arrest. And that's why it required a Miranda warning and one was not given here, which of course violated her constitutional rights. So next, turning to the district court's decision to find that the exception to Miranda applied under the rescue doctrine. Now, in order for the rescue doctrine to apply, you have to have an urgency of need that no other course of action promises relief. And the purpose of that is to save a human life or to rescue someone whose life is in danger. It requires immediate and imminent danger. That's not what we had in this case. There was no urgency of need here to rescue this purported boyfriend that Miss Waldron had talked about. There were other officers who had already investigated the scene of the accident and ascertained that there was no one else in the vehicle at the time of the accident. There were still officers at that scene and able to search for this boyfriend while Miss Waldron was being questioned. But it's clear from the questions and the manner in which they were asked, that was not the purpose of the questioning. And even if it was the purpose of the questioning, it was not the only way to accomplish that course of action in rescuing the other individual in the vehicle. There were other officers who could have taken care of that at the time. And additionally, even if they thought there may have been someone else in the vehicle, there's nothing to indicate that this line of questioning was necessary to save a human life. She didn't indicate that her boyfriend was injured and bloody and in need of medical attention. There were vague statements, confused about who was the driver of the vehicle. And the purpose of asking those questions was not to save a human life. The purpose was to get Ms. Waldron to incriminate herself. Therefore, the rescue doctrine was misapplied here, and it was erroneous. Moving on to the voluntariness of the statement. So even if this court finds that this statement was not obtained in violation of Miranda, we still need to decide whether this statement was voluntary and what effect the finding of incompetence has on the voluntariness of that statement. It's undisputed that at the time Ms. Waldron made that statement, she was legally incompetent and not criminally responsible for her words or actions. Now, incompetence alone doesn't make a statement involuntary. I concede that you do have to have a coercive police atmosphere. There must be some state action that induces someone and causes their will to be overborne when it otherwise would not have been. We do have that in this situation. First, looking to the subjective factors about Ms. Waldron, her age, maturity, intelligence, and experience with the criminal justice system. And of course, the most important factor here, that she was incompetent at the time. Now, looking to the interrogation objective factors of the police here.
Can I ask you a question about that? Yes. And it might just be my lack of experience. I usually think of a competency evaluation as to determine whether the person is competent to proceed in the legal proceedings against them, not a expert opinion as to whether at the time that an alleged crime was committed, they were
competent. I'm not sure what that meaning of competence means there, because competence means something different to me in terms of being able to understand the nature of charges, et cetera. So let's pretend there wasn't a Rule 20 competency examination here. And the person's argument, your client's argument, is simply, I'd injure, you know, they put in other evidence, et cetera, you know, an expert says, oh, injured herself at the time and had a head injury, et cetera. How does that go to the voluntariness if there's not any sort of misconduct or coercion found by law enforcement?
Well, the effect of the brain injury that she was suffering from, the effect of a head injury or of a severe mental illness, does affect the analysis of whether or not a confession is voluntary. Under Colorado v. Connolly, the U.S. Supreme Court case, that makes it clear that we do need some coercive action by police. They are also clear to point out that it is relevant. In this case, the defendant had psychosis and thought that God was telling him to confess to murder. That is a factor when deciding whether it was a voluntary statement. The person's mental illness at the time, the person's brain injury, and its effect on their ability to have their will be overborne by police action is absolutely relevant to the analysis.
And the coercion here again is what?
So, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Go ahead.
So the coercion here is the inherently coercive atmosphere that she was placed in. She had come to this home seeking help. She was in distress and she was very injured. We've all reviewed the video recording here. It's clear that she's crying out in pain and she's pleading with the officer to please help her. He's not helping her. He's refusing to move her arm. He's telling her to hold still. He's not providing her any aid during this time, but he does proceed to question her.
Well, he was repeatedly telling her that paramedics were on the way and they were trying to get her medical assistance. I mean, it was, you know, probably not a great idea for him as a non-medical professional to, you know, get in there and move her around, right? So how is that coercive?
Alone, the fact that he didn't move her around isn't coercive. But the fact that he didn't cease his questioning and didn't at least wait until emergency personnel were there, could evaluate her, that created the coercive atmosphere. She was crying out in pain. And she was, as we know from the competency evaluation, suffering from a head injury that made her incompetent and not responsible for her actions or words at that time. So the actions of the officer that may not in all situations be coercive are more coercive under these circumstances when you look to the subjective factors of the defendant and how the actions of the officer may have affected her and how they may have overborne her will and caused her to confess to things that she would not otherwise have done so had she been in her right state of mind. In addition, it was clear that the officer wasn't believing the answers that she was saying and wasn't taking her seriously, saying that, well, you shouldn't have been driving when she was clearly crying out in pain. These are all actions that indicate he was not sympathizing with the extreme amount of pain and distress that she was in. And again, adding to that coercive atmosphere that this person is not there to help her. And perhaps she could get help if she does what he tells her to do. I would like to turn to the last issue here, Rule of Evidence 403. Even if this court finds that statements were properly admitted under Miranda and that her statement wasn't involuntary, the manner in which this statement was presented to the jury was extremely prejudicial, and its prejudice substantially outweighed any probative value this statement may have had. Now, I may not have a strong argument if they had been permitted simply to talk about the statements that she'd made. The officer here testified. The officer who questioned her testified and did speak about the statements she made. But in addition to that, the recorded squad video in its entirety was played for the jury. That is extremely prejudicial. It shows Ms. Waldron in a state where she is panicked, hurt, seeking help, belligerent, not making any sense, making inconsistent and incoherent statements. It's extremely prejudicial, and this was presented to the jury and used as evidence of her guilt. Additionally, the probative value of this was extremely low. There were other alternative, less prejudicial means they could have used to present this information. The officer could have testified that she said her boyfriend was driving and then said her boyfriend wasn't driving. That would have gotten the exact same information to the jury, to the finder of fact, without this extremely prejudicial manner in which it was presented. It cannot be said that the way this evidence was presented did not have a significant impact on the jury reaching its verdict. So regardless, we think that the evidence should absolutely have been suppressed under Rule of Evidence 403. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes rebuttal, counsel, for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Tyler Kenefick. I'm Assistant St. Louis County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. Miranda was designed, and the cases that follow it, to prevent police misconduct and using coercive tactics to get incriminating statements from people that are in custody. From its inception, Miranda has made clear that on-scene investigations, fact-finding determinations are not covered under Miranda. A warning is only provided when there is a custodial interrogation equivalent to an individual being put under formal arrest. Ms. Waldron, in this case, was at no point put under arrest. Ms. Waldron, officers were dispatched to an accident scene where a serious accident occurred, a rollover with a vehicle in the ditch. They discovered an individual that was injured in a nearby house who had come and seeking aid. They responded to that address and immediately sought medical assistance. From the beginning, Ms. Waldron was claiming that another individual was in this accident, the same accident that caused Ms. Waldron to have a serious brain injury or concussion, and other injuries as well. It's absolutely reasonable for an officer to assume or to at least suspect that someone else may be present in that accident and seriously hurt. The officer's questioning of the victim, of Ms. Waldron, was completely rational in trying to figure out exactly what happened during that accident. And that type of on-scene questioning has again and again and again been held to be constitutionally valuable or viable, even without a Miranda warning. The officer at all times when speaking with Ms. Waldron indicated that medical personnel were on the way and that they were going to take care of her. There is no way that Ms. Waldron would think that she was being placed under formal arrest because she was never informed she was in arrest. She was not put in handcuffs. Officers did not draw a weapon. Officers were simply speaking with her and asking her what happened that night. That is pretty much the exact example in Miranda that indicates there is not a custodial interrogation and that a Miranda warning does not have to be given. Because of that, there is absolutely no need for him to give Miranda, and the fact that he didn't doesn't suppress or necessitate the suppression of the statement. Additionally, as to the voluntariness, as counsel conceded, there needs to be the reason for why a statement's non-voluntary must be caused by law enforcement. That's because the constitutional basis for excluding involuntary statements are to prevent police misconduct. There was no misconduct here. The trooper was simply asking questions following up regarding an accident, a very serious accident, and her claim that another individual was present, that they might need to help. Yes, they went out and also investigated the scene. They should have to take all courses of action to determine whether another person is present. But the best course of action to determine another person was present was to talk to Ms. Waldron, the only individual that was known to be present at the accident. So that was completely rational, and there was no course of steps taken by the trooper to speak or to get Ms. Waldron to provide statement.
May I ask, would it have been coercion if the purpose of the questioning was to find out, in fact, if Ms. Waldron was driving the car?
No, Your Honor. As indicated in my brief, a number of times there's been questioning that has been asked, who is the driver? Were you driving? And that's been deemed not sufficiently coercive in order to get an individual in custody and require a Miranda warning. But aside from that, in pretty much every constitutional argument, courts apply an objective standard, and they do not look at the individual motivations of a police officer. And that was actually mentioned in the brief regarding California's decision to actually overturn the case that this court relied on in Provost, the emergency aid doctrine. They explicitly repudiated the notion that an officer should be, the subjective motivation for an officer should be looked at, because officers act for different motives, and ultimately the determination should be what an objective officer would do with the facts and the knowledge at the time. So I don't think it necessarily matters what the individual motivation of the trooper is as to whether it was coercive or not. As to the probative value, I don't see how there isn't probative value in how an individual is acting after an accident and determining whether they're under the influence. It is true that she had a concussion. That could be an alternative explanation, but the defense was free to raise that to the jury and argue that. This is an instance where the fact finder, the jury, had the evidence put in front of them. The defense was more than free to bring in an expert and say what condition she is in, whether her statement was reliable, and they chose not to. It's not the state's burden to provide a defense as well. This is an instance where the state provided evidence that was most directly on point to the case and let the jury decide on the facts. That's exactly what the jury system is designed to do. Additionally, I want to briefly address this notion that there's alternate, that thinks that defense counsel seem to imply that another investigation conducted at the scene concluded that another person was not present in the accident. If that was the case, then simply put, then it doesn't matter whether this statement came in or not, because if that was conclusive enough to prove beyond reasonable doubt to officers that no one was present, then that mission of the statement wouldn't affect the outcome of the case. Ultimately, I think it was good to have both. However, the fact that no one was present or no footprints came from the vehicle led officers to suspect that Ms. Waldron was not being truthful with them does not negate their obligation and wanting to follow up on those statements. Your Honors, I pretty much have said my piece, and if there's no further questions, I'll concede the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no questions, thank you, counsel. We'll turn to you, counsel, for appellant, for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points. Respondents, counsel points to the fact that the Ms. Waldron was permitted to leave at the end of questioning, but the Miranda analysis doesn't require that someone is arrested at the end of a Miranda or at the end of an interview for Miranda to apply. There's many cases where Miranda is applied and the statements found to be in violation of Miranda, even though the person questioned was allowed to leave at the end of the encounter. And in this situation, she was not allowed to walk away at the end of the encounter. Ms. Waldron was detained by EMS staff and officers. She was handcuffed and then placed in the back of an ambulance and watched by an armed officer the entire time. And then another car followed the ambulance and was at her with her at her side at the hospital the entire time as well. So although she wasn't placed in custody in a jail cell, she was still under that same custodial status when she was being interviewed in the home, when she was placed in the back of that ambulance, and when she was at the hospital, which is probably why she was finally given a Miranda warning at the hospital by the officer. Additionally, she was, although she wasn't arrested, she was also never told she could leave. She was not permitted to leave. It was clear that she was going to be forced, and she was forced to go with the EMTs to the hospital that day. In response to the respondent's counsel's argument regarding if they'd already ascertained there was no other driver at the scene of the accident, then asking her where the other driver is or if she's the driver has little probative value. I would agree that has little probative value, which is exactly why it should not have been admitted into evidence under Rule 403. The low probative value of any information that could have come from Ms. Waldron during her unintelligible ramblings about who was the driver of the vehicle was not probative at all to the issues in this case. There was additional evidence that came in on that fact.
But wasn't it her defense that she wasn't driving, or that she, I don't know what her defense was, that she couldn't remember what happened?
Correct. She believed that she was not the driver of the vehicle, but she also waived her right to remain silent and did testify as such at trial.
So how is it not probative to that defense?
Well, I'm responding to respondent's assertion that it's not probative. And if it wasn't probative, then that helps the 403 analysis because the prejudicial value is extremely high. I do agree that the probative value of her statements generally about whether or not she was the driver, it does have probative value to this case. But ultimately, the way in which they were submitted to the jury was highly prejudicial. They should have just been able to testify about these statements. Trooper Allen testified about all the statements that Ms. Waldron made to him. Then those statements were played on the live recording to the jury. They heard them twice. They did not need to have a cumulative presentation of this evidence, and especially since the way in which the recording presented these statements was extremely prejudicial. Seeing this woman crying out in pain, acting unintelligible, incoherent, is extremely prejudicial, especially in a case where she's alleged to be driving under the influence. That all of that evidence could have come out through alternative, less prejudicial means, through either the trooper who testified to all of that evidence anyway, and through Ms. Waldron herself. And if there's no further questions, we'd ask that this court reverse the lower court's decision to deny the motion to suppress. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your briefing, for your arguments today. We appreciate it. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period. Thank you.
Thank you.